Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Listening to nature's symphonies to make sense of our own. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and today, the first of a two-part series on music and animals, plus a preview of this week's South by Southwest Music Festival in Austin, Texas, and a live performance from British folk rock artist Frank Turner. But first, when was the last time you really stopped and listened? Not to your iPod, not to the person on the other end of the cell phone call, but to the sounds around you. Musician and naturalist Bernie Krause has devoted the past 40 years of his life to doing just that, listening and recording the sounds of the world's environments. His new book is called The Great Animal Orchestra, Finding the Origins of Music in the World's Wild Places. Bernie joins me now by phone from Glen Ellyn, California. Welcome to Soundcheck, Bernie.
Thanks, John.
What are we hearing in the background here?
Well, you're hearing a fall soundscape from Yellowstone National Park, and it includes birds like flickers and Wilson's warbler, red-tailed hawks, golden eagles, warblers and sparrows, all kinds of birds. We've got about 30 birds in that one representation.
So you use the term soundscape, which, you know, is a good way of describing such a kind of a richly textured recording. You also compare it at various points in your book to a symphony, you know, just like in a symphony orchestra, different instruments have their own range and you know, find ways to work with each other. Are the birds and the other animals in that recording from Yellowstone, are they sort of doing the same thing?
Yes, they are. And what they're doing is they're forming niches so that each voice in the animal orchestra can be heard. I call that a biophony. It's the part of the soundscape that comes from the natural world and organic natural world.
Mm-hmm. As opposed to a geophony, which would be the wind and waves and things like
that. Exactly right. Those are natural sounds, too.
Mm-hmm. Now, in a soundscape like this, I mean, if we were to go back, you know, tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of years to humans pre-language, where would we have found a niche in one of these soundscapes of our own?
Well, what we had to do early on, before we got to language, is we were mimicking the sounds. We're very good improvisers, and we were mimicking the sounds that we heard around us. Because early on, we still considered ourselves very much a part of the natural world, not disconnected in any way. And so we mimicked the sounds.
Mockingbirds of a sort.
We were mockingbirds of a sort. But even more important than that, because we had the complex brains that were able to figure out complex patterns, we imitated the structures of those sounds. In other words, all of the animals, the insects, the birds, the mammals, the frogs, and so on, they all find niches or bandwidth within which to vocalize so that their voices aren't masked by others, just like instruments in an orchestra.
Right.
And that's how we got that kind of orchestration idea.
So it seems like, as you write about some of the many recordings that you've made all over the world, that certain patterns seem to emerge, insects especially, provide a kind of drone, you know, this kind.
Exactly right. It's like the difference, John, between hearing a Mozart symphony and a Charles Ives symphony.
Mm-hmm.
You immediately know which of these composers is being performed, if you're familiar with music, of course,
right.
and you can tell the difference between them because of their structure.
Mm-hmm.
Now, and the same thing happens in habitats.
And in habitats where there are primates, you know, are they kind of the last to find their, do they wait to see what's going on around them sonically before finding their niche?
That is a really great question, and hardly anybody ever asks that. And of course, the soundscape reveals the answer. What happens is, during the course of the day, the sounds come into the spectrum. Like, for instance, insects start somewhere around midnight or 2 o'clock in the morning. And gradually, first the insects happen, and then the and then the reptiles, and then the amphibians, and then the birds and the mammals. In almost an evolutionary order, they enter into the soundscape.
Wow.
And it's absolutely astonishing.
So as, you know, as not only primates, but as we assume the most highly evolved primates, we would have been last on the scene and last to join this kind of natural orchestra.
Exactly right. And we had to find niches for ourselves so our voices could be heard. And we did.
Hi, we're speaking with Bernie Krause, longtime musician, naturalist, author of the new book, The Great Animal Orchestra. Here's an example of what he's talking about. This is a bit of a soundscape recorded in Borneo, and you will prominently hear a primate, the ape known as a gibbon. So there's a whole soundscape there, lots of insects, and this thing that almost sounds, Bernie, almost sounds like a bird, like a, you know, an Australian lyrebird or something. That's the gibbon, right?
That's exactly right. And they sing duets. They pair together for life, and they sing these duets in sync with one another and in sync with the other gibbons in the habitat, in that habitat. And, you know, the Dyak used to say that a tribe that lives in Borneo. They said that the sound of the gibbon is so beautiful that the songs cause the sun to rise in response.
Hmm. And do the songs of that tribe in Borneo, I mean, you know, do you hear them mimicking the sounds of the gibbons in their music?
Absolutely, as many groups who still live closely connected to the natural world do.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned before that humans, you know, have this gift for mimicry. And I sort of, you know, offhandedly mentioned mockingbirds. But, you know, do other animals have that same gift? Do you hear gibbons? You know, do their calls sound so bird-like? I mean, I know you're not a zoologist, but, you know, just from your research into this and your many years of making these recordings, have you come across other species that have this kind of mimicry to them?
Oh, absolutely. Like killer whales, for instance. I have a recording of a killer whale, which we haven't got here, but I have a recording of a killer whale that actually mimics the sounds of seals barking.
And why does he do that?
Well, my guess is he's looking for food, and so he's trying to draw them in.
Uh-huh.
And what a great way to do that.
Yeah. So when the first humans came on the scene, what would eventually become our music was what? Us imitating the sounds in these soundscapes around us?
Well, just think about that for a second. We used the sounds of the forest as a natural karaoke orchestra with which we performed.
Hmm.
So we were part of the symphony.
Now, one of the sort of basic melodic patterns that humans use throughout the world. We hear it in the blues, we hear it in Central Africa, we hear it in Southeast Asia, is this so-called pentatonic scale, this five-note scale.
Exactly right.
And you've found that in the animal kingdom as well, right?
Well, they're the ones that taught us.
So let's hear two of your recordings. Bernie Krause on the line with us from Glen Ellyn, California. First, the common patou from Central and South America, and then the aptly named musician wren. The common patou and the musician wren. The common patou, Bernie, that's just a pretty standard descending pentatonic scale, but then this wren is doing all kinds of trills and warbles and stuff.
Isn't that amazing?
It really
is. The melodies that these birds put out, that common patou is it sounds like blues.
Absolutely.
Boy, I could play that on my guitar.
Yeah. So have we as humans, you know, once we came on the scene and started imitating it, did we at some point then get disassociated from it to, you know, to our own and perhaps to the animal's disadvantage?
Well, what happened, it happened rather slowly and kind of under the radar. And as science began to take hold, 15th, 16th, 17th century, we began to separate these critters out into, you know, kind of abstracted the natural world, deconstructed it, fragmented it, to get to what we thought was a better understanding by dealing with single critters. But this didn't, you know, what we found is we had these huge libraries of single individual voices and birds in these drawers at museums, individual birds all lined up. But we didn't learn much from the individual critters, and we had to kind of put the world back together again and try to figure out how they were working in context with one another.
Mm.
And so what I've done in the last 40 years is I've been really looking at a more holistic view of the soundscapes of the natural world. And instead of fracturing and splintering the world apart and recording individual birds, I've been recording whole soundscapes to see how their voices fit, because we get a lot more information from that. Don't forget that not only does the soundscape inform us about language and music, but it also teaches us about biology and resource management, medicine, architecture, literature, physics, and so many more subjects that it's just incredible what's going on with the idea of soundscapes now.
Mm. And what about the impact that we are having on those soundscapes? I mean, you recorded some stuff in 1988 at a place called Lincoln Meadow.
This
is in the Sierra Nevadas.
Yes.
And, you know, what was the attraction, first of all, of this particular place?
Well, first of all, it was pristine, and it was pretty much untouched. And we got word from one of the lumber companies, local lumber companies, that they were going to do selective logging up there, which was then a new process, and that the selective logging was going to have absolutely no impact on the biophony or the natural soundscape. And so we went up there and said, fine, okay, let us record before you go in and do your selective logging and after, and let's compare and see if there's any problem. So in 1988, they went in and I went in and did the recording at Lincoln Meadow, which is a place about 4 hours east of San Francisco, and got this first soundscape example. And then a year after, they had done selective logging. They had done all during the summer of 1988. And in 1989, I went back and recorded again. And the soundscape had changed so radically. But what was interesting about this, John, is that when you take a look at that site with your naked eye or with a camera, it looks exactly the same. It looks unchanged.
Mm.
But you know, I have this expression, a picture is worth 1,000 words.
Yeah.
Well, a soundscape is worth 1,000 pictures.
Well, let's hear that before and after, these audio images of Lincoln Meadow in the Sierra Nevadas of California, first before the logging operation in 1988. That's 1988. 1 year later, same place. Bernie Krause with the same equipment recording this version. Bernie Krause is with us on the line from Glen Ellyn, California. The musician and naturalist is author of the book The Great Animal Orchestra. So that 1989, that's a year after the logging, suddenly I'm hearing the local stream or brook or whatever that is.
That's it.
Which had been masked by all the other sounds a year earlier.
That's exactly right. And all the other, the density and the diversity and really the wonder of the spot is completely missing.
So it's the same time of year in the same spot?
Exactly right. And I've done recording there 15 times since. Same time of year, same conditions. And it is still very depressing.
Wow. Bernie Krause is a musician, naturalist. His book is called The Great Animal Orchestra, Finding the Origins of Music in the World's Wild Places. So obviously we've had a big impact, a big influence on the sounds of the world around us. What about the influence of those sounds on us, you know, as we were beginning as a species to make music, to have language? I mean, this is a big, in the field of neuroscience, and you write about this in the book, this is a very contentious issue. You know, which came first? Was there a music instinct, a language instinct? Where do you think those come from?
Well, I think it started first with music because we were imitating the animals and we were learning language through a musical progression. I'm not a linguist, so I don't know that for a fact. But my guess is, my hunch is, it probably came through music first. But you know something, the evolution of this and the impact that these soundscapes have on us is profound. For instance, if you listen to music, there are a lot of, and here's another thing that that comes up often, and is, you know, debatable. Some people think that music heals.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you have to remember that music is culturally biased. So sometimes music will heal for one person, but not another.
Right.
So music is not universal in that sense, but natural soundscapes are unassailable in that regard. When you put on either a forest or an ocean sound or a desert soundscape, and you play these for people, immediately, the glucocorticoid enzyme level that causes stress drops in people. This is almost universal. And people haven't really done enough research on it to be able to confirm that this is true. But these tribes that I mentioned in the book, there are three of them. There's the Bayaka, who live in the Central African Republic, the Kalali, who live in New Guinea, Papua New Guinea, and the Hivaro, who live in the Amazon Basin.
Mm-hmm.
They all go back to the forest to heal, and it's the soundscape that gives them this kind of centeredness that's both spiritual and physical and psychological.
And your colleague, Louis Sarno, American ethnomusicologist, has actually made some very famous recordings of the Bayaka, otherwise known as the Babenzele, pygmies of Central Africa. Here's one of them. That's a song of the Bayaka people of Central Africa, the Central African Republic. The Women Here, recorded by Louis Sarno. Bernie Krause, Louis didn't layer a recording of them singing over sound effects of the forest. That took place within that.
Oh, that's natural.
Yeah.
It's absolutely natural. And what you're hearing there is the women using the sounds of that forest as that karaoke orchestra I was talking about before.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, they're singing with that whole orchestration. And they've created their music, they've developed their music as a result of that.
And what about today? I mean, you talk about, you know, a surprising array of contemporary musicians, from the Beatles and Frank Zappa to the Canadian composer R. Murray Schafer, who have, to some extent, been aware of the effects of natural sounds and have tried to weave them into their music. Do you see that as kind of hope for the future?
Yes, I do. And it's a wonderful resource for musicians to get out there in the field and actually record. And there are a few who are doing that, Schafer being one of them, a fellow by the name of David Manacchi from Italy, who's a professor of music in Italy, who's actually spending a lot of time in the rainforests of Brazil and Borneo and other places in the world to get these biophonies with which he actually performs live. In other words, he streams a spectrogram across a big screen in back of him, and he plays this transverse flute to the sounds of the natural world.
So he's sort of responding to what he's hearing.
And it's absolutely remarkable. Mm. It's some of the most engaging music I've ever heard.
Well, we're going to actually hear a little bit of the Canadian composer R. Murray Schafer and a piece called Once on a Windy Night, and I think you'll hear some of this effect that Bernie's been talking about. We've been speaking with Bernie Krause, author of The Great Animal Orchestra, Finding the Origins of Music in the World's Wild Places, full of some pretty amazing tales of Bernie's adventures recording around the globe. And Bernie, a real pleasure to have you with us on Soundcheck today. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much, John.
In a moment, a soundscape of a very different sort. The South by Southwest Music Festival starts officially tomorrow in Austin, and we'll get a preview from the Wall Street Journal's Jim Fusilli. And later in the show, the folk punk troubadour Frank Turner. He's going to South by Southwest too, but first, he'll stop by our studio for a live performance. Rock and roll.